This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today I'm really delighted to welcome a true Canadian music icon to the program. Jake Gold is synonymous with the most successful band in Canadian history, the Tragically Hip, as their longtime manager, also as one of the foremost judges on Canadian Idol, and of course, as executive producer of the highly acclaimed and spectacular film, The Tragically Hip No Dress Rehearsal, which just premiered at TIFF and is now streaming on Amazon Prime. Before we meet him, let me tell you a little bit more about him. Jake Gold is one of Canada's most successful artist managers, and for its six-season run, he was a judge on the national television hit Canadian Idol. Almost 40 years ago, he started his artist management company, The Management Trust, through which he is best known for his role in establishing and really transforming the Tragically Hip into a national icon. In 2020, Gold reunited with the band to direct their legacy in Canadian music history. He also manages acclaimed pop rock band The Pursuit of Happiness and music producers Mo Berg, Lawrence Curry, and Russell Broome, and he co-manages the quickly rising pop R&B act Ethan Sermon alongside Ryan Hefford. Gold has been recognized by the annual Canadian Music Industry Awards as Manager of the Year in 1991, 93, and 94. And in 2013, he was the recipient of the MMF Honor Roll Award for his Lifetime Achievement Award in the field of artist management. In 2023, CIMA awarded Gold the Change Award for his many years of service to the board. Later that year, he was also honored, along with his clients, the Tragically Hip, with the Founder Award from War Child Canada for their continued contribution to the charity. And in 2024, Jake was inducted into the Canadian Music Industry Hall of Fame. Congratulations on that and on all of this. Jake currently sits on the Connect Music Board as well as the ReSound Board. Jake Gold, longest bio ever. Welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
Well, you didn't have to read the whole thing. It's just visit my website and read it, you know.
It always sounds better, though. It always sounds better.
You do it well, Judy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Let's start at the very beginning. Let's go back to grade six, because I love that story. So you're managing this group of girls.
It was three girls. One of them played guitar and the other two sang, with the third that played guitar.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's so cool. And after a few weeks under your tutelage, under your wing, as it were, they ended up winning the talent competition they'd entered. And this was really a foreshadowing, I thought, of much of your career as the longtime manager of the most famous band ever in this country, the Tragically Hip. And I think also for your six-year stint as a judge on Canadian Idol. So what was it that you did? How did you know instinctively how to do it, how to be an excellent manager?
You know, I always had a thing for music, and it was funny because that whole story was reminded to me by guys. I still play cards with these guys from high school and junior high and even public school. There's a couple of them from public school that were there, and they reminded me of it. One day we were playing and they said, you know, you always got to do what you wanted to do. And I was like, why do you say that? And then they reminded me of that story. And I actually posted it on Instagram a few years ago, and the girls chimed in and said,
wow,
because we follow each other, you know, and they chimed in. And apparently, I laugh when I think about it now, but I named them Jake's Golden Girls.
I love that.
This is before the Golden Girls, the show even existed, right?
Yes, and yes.
Now we're all old enough to be the Golden Girls. So, yeah. But I don't know. I was just like, they wanted to do it. And I said, well, I'll rehearse you. Like, I listen to a lot of music and I'll rehearse you. And we spent 2 weeks in one of their basements just rehearsing. And they won the talent contest. And then I played in bands. Like, I sang in bands for many years, high school bands, cover bands. And then I went on the road with bands, and then moved to LA from 79 to 81. I was born in the US, so I have dual citizenship. Yeah. And then when I came back, a friend of mine had a band that was going on the road. They had a record deal. They wanted me to be their tour manager, lighting guy. And they ended up breaking up before the tour started. And then they reformed with a new guitar player, and they approached me and they said, "We want you to be our manager." And I said, "Well, I don't know anything about it." And they said, "Don't worry, you'll be good."
And I went, they do.
Okay. And that's what I've done ever since. So it's now I'm in my 44th year. I guess March, April will be 44 years.
Wow.
So,
that's tremendous.
The only, outside of the TV show, it's the only thing I've ever done.
That's tremendous. You've said that managing the Tragically Hip for the first 17 years was like, and I love this analogy, a manager is like being the CEO of a company and the band is the board of directors. It's their business, but you're running it. Can you say more?
Well, it's funny because at the time, I don't think I saw things that way. And the more board of directors I've been on in organizations, because I do a lot of work in the industry, it became apparent. I said, "Oh, okay, I see what's going on. We, you know, we have a board of directors, but we hire a CEO to run the organization, or we hire a president to run the org." And then it dawned on me. I said, "Oh, that's what managers do. The band's the board of directors, and we're the CEOs that run the business for them."
So cool.
And when I came back with the guys in 2020, one of the first things I did was, because I was had all this experience since I worked with them, because I didn't do any of that stuff when I was working with them. That all happened after the fact.
Oh, wow.
I said to them, I said, "Well, we need to treat this like, in order for us to get stuff done, because we have a lot of stuff we have to do, we need to start treating it the way real businesses run." I said, "You guys are the board of directors. I'm the CEO. So we need to have board of directors meetings every 2 weeks. And then we would take notes every meeting. And then the notes, the minutes would go out after the meeting to everybody with action items and everything else."
Wow.
And interestingly enough, this happened in June of 2020. We were in COVID mode. No one was leaving their house. So it actually enabled us to get more done.
Yes.
Because we didn't have to travel. So what came out of COVID was us actually having something to do and getting together every 2 weeks to have discussions. And at the beginning, the meetings were long. They were 2 and 3 hours. Mm-hmm. Now our meetings get done in an hour, 45 minutes, because things are ongoing. And, you know, we're doing a lot of communication in terms of action stuff via email. But at the beginning, it was all brand new and fresh. So one of the good things that came out of COVID is being able to communicate like this, like even this right here.
Of course.
No one was really doing, you know, I would normally have to go sit down with you in a studio and do this. We're now, you know, I'm saving travel time and schedules and all that other stuff. So
absolutely. So a life-changing event for you, and there's been many, Jake, would be when you met Alan Gregg at a party in December 1985. You were introduced to him, and he had to go excuse himself to take a phone call. And you then realized that phone call was from the Prime Minister. And you were shocked, and you said at the time, "Who is this guy, this Alan Gregg?"
Right.
Can you tell us more about that meeting and how it led to you partnering together in your very successful management company?
So I had already been a manager for about 4 or 5 years at the time. We met in December 85. We met at an industry event. He was an investor in a music magazine that was throwing their Christmas party. And we had agreed that we were going to get together the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And we got together, and that's when he took the call. Hmm. We weren't going to be partners or anything. I was working with another guy. But Alan had been backing this artist that he had known most of his life, and he wanted some help putting on a showcase and getting some people out to see this guy. Wow. And I agreed to help him. And about a month later, late January, things that with the guy I was working with wasn't really working out. There was a lot of issues, and I decided I'm going to go on my own. And I called Alan and I said, "I won't be at the office anymore. I'm going to work from my home for now." And this is pre-email, pre-fax. Wow. Even. This is, I think faxes had just started to come out, but
wow,
because not everyone had one, there wasn't really a network. And so it was all over the phone. And so you could use your home phone. But Alan said, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "I'm just going to work from home and, you know, figure it out." I had some of my own acts, and I had a recording act, and I had a couple of cover bands I was working with to, you know, make a living. And he said, "Well, why don't you come over? Let's have a chat." So I went over there, and we put together a cash flow projection and looked at what the cost was going to be to start a company. And he said, okay, I'll back it. You do the work and we'll see where it goes. Wow. That was January 31st of 86. In August, we got sent a cassette tape of The Tragically Hip. So
by Hugh Siegel. Hugh Siegel sent you that cassette tape.
Yeah. And Hugh was a friend of Alan's through the political world. So, and you know, that's how that started. So, you know, we had put on the showcase for his act and I was working with my existing act. So we were just starting a management company and who knew where things were going to go. And it just so happened we got sent this tape. So,
and so you get sent this tape and you go, we got to go see them. And you go and you knew within 30 seconds, you said, you just knew. And I think that's probably what makes you a great manager is you just, your instincts are good. You know when that person has the it factor. What was it in that first song and a half that made you turn to him, to Alan Greggs, and say, we got to sign these guys tonight?
It wasn't even the first song and a half. It was literally the first 30 seconds. I mean, Alan says in the documentary about a minute and a half in or a song and a half in, for me, it was instant. And I got to be honest with you, I don't know if that makes me a great manager. I think that part of my job, that's only part of it, is to be able to spot charisma. But, you know, there's so much more to the job than that. There are plenty of people out there that I know that have been able to spot talent, but actually can't finish the job, you know? Right. So there's a joke in the industry that says, you know, anybody can have a hit. It's whether you can actually keep them there is the real test of being a good manager. It's one thing to get lucky and have a hit. It's another thing to maintain that. So I think anybody in the room that day would have felt the same because they were opening for Rolling Stones clone band playing 70% original music. And it was Larry's Hideaway. And back then, all the bars, they were not stand-up bars. You did not stand up in front of the stage. They were all like cabaret style. It was tables and chairs, and that's how you watched the show. And at the end of their 40-minute set, the whole place stood up and gave them a standing O. So all that did was reaffirmed what I felt when I first saw them, when I first heard the first notes, is I went, okay, we're on to something because they're not just moving us. They're moving all these people that did not know this band before.
Wow. Did you have a sense, do you think, at that time that, you know, many bands only last for 4 months? Not necessarily that they would go on to become the number one band in the country, but that there was something really special here. This was going to have some legs in a very big way.
Yeah, we did. And there was a lot of naysayers. There was a lot of, we got a lot of no's at the beginning. And we just persevered because we believed. You know, we knew that if we built a constituency amongst the fans, that the gatekeepers, you know, the people at radio and media and record companies, they couldn't stop us.
Right.
Because we knew ultimately the fan is the customer. So if we can create direct access to fans, then the rest of those people are just going to play catch up with us. And that was always the ethos.
So cool. So you started working with Jake in 1986 and started getting them gigs and the gigs started getting bigger. And you've said, and it's been said that they were like machines. They were working so hard performing in small music venues all across Ontario and you managed them really well. And they started to build a strong following, but they still weren't signed. And you also helped make that happen. In 1988, you got a call from then MCA Records Vice President Bruce Dickinson. And after hearing their music on a multi-artist CD, he asked to see them. He flew from New York to see the band show at Massey. And you were worried about this because this was just a two-song award show. And you tried to say this to Bruce. And he said, no, no, it's okay. It's okay. I still want to come. And then the terrible thing happened where Gord Downie's mic fell apart. The cable fell apart. And what did Gord Downie do? He made it part of the act. He improvised. Right? I mean, you can tell this better in your own words, but what are your memories of that night?
You're doing just fine, Judy. Yeah, I'm listening.
But, you know, I mean, what's so cool is that, like, I wonder, you know, if he hadn't have done that, if he would have panicked and said, oh my God, there's no mic, there's no cable, we're screwed, what are we going to do? It could have all been over, but he improvised. Like, this was part of his greatness, too, was he was fearless, right? And he just made it work, and the guy loved him.
And the band didn't stop. That's an important part. It wasn't just him, as they kept playing, right?
Yes.
They didn't stop. The interesting story about that is that I had always had an another gig set up for them the next day for this guy to see. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
At the Horseshoe Tavern, I called the Horseshoe and say, can we get on at 8 o'clock? I want this guy to see the band, because we had always set that up anyways. And because you didn't have the ability to communicate to the fans like you do today, where you could go on social and say, we're playing a show last minute tomorrow, or go to radio and have them announce it. We didn't want to do any of that. So the band played at 8 o'clock to not a full house, because it was whoever happened to be at the club to see the band that was playing later on. They just let us come on and do a set for the guy. So he was already sold the night before, you know, on especially Gord's spontaneous behavior and the band, how tight they were and how they kept going. It's funny because when I talk to Bruce now, because Bruce sits in our meetings, our planning meetings and everything, his recollection is different than mine. He thinks I surprised him with the show. And the thing was, the show, and I have to remind him, no, Bruce, the show was always planned. You were always staying 2 days, not 1 day. And, you know, but I remember standing beside him at the Horseshoe, because what he said the night before is, he said, I want to sign these guys. Let's have lunch tomorrow. If their heads are screwed on straight, I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
And I knew at that point we didn't have a problem, because these guys were very committed. But that night he stood beside me and watched them do a full set with real sound and, you know, everything. And and he looked at me and he goes, I can't believe this band isn't signed. And all the Canadian labels had passed.
Right. Yeah,
so it took this guy from New York to come up and go, holy, you know, but word got out amongst the music community. So all of a sudden, because this guy from New York's there, all the other record labels showed up.
Yes.
Right. They're all like, oh, the New York guy's here. There must be something that we didn't figure out.
Right.
Right.
And you're like, too late.
Yeah.
We believe in this guy because he believes in us. You never stopped looking out for the Hip to get them out of Ontario and all across the country. I know you believe they needed a calling card. They needed to make a music video, which was just becoming a thing, right? Which would legitimize them. Can you tell us how you achieved that, and what happened with that music video, and how did that lead to?
That was prior to getting signed. We had put out an EP independently. Well, we had it distributed through RCA.
Yes.
But it was like a 1 year license deal. So, you know, we made a video. We were backing it. Alan and I were backing it through the company. And, you know, we hired a guy named Scott Eldridge to direct the video. So we did that. But we knew that the EP wasn't as good as the band was live.
Right.
So one of the things we instructed the PR department to do was, when you're talking to media in each city, ask them not to review the EP, but to come to the show and review the show.
Yes.
Because we wanted them to tell everyone how great the show was.
Yes.
So the next time we came through, more people would read that and show up. Because for us, it was always about building the constituency of the fans. So we even had a writer in Calgary said, you know, save the $6 on the record and go see the show, which was the greatest thing we could ever have for someone to say. And we would use that as a promo thing, you know, like so-and-so says, save the $6. And the record company's like, you're telling them not to buy the record. And we would be like,
don't worry. It's all going to stand us in good stead. So it's all good. It's all good.
This is about a much longer plan than this one record.
A big picture perspective. So the band is signed to a 7-record deal early January in Memphis, Tennessee. And suddenly 5 guys from Kingston are about to put out their first major record deal. And thanks to a stream of rock radio hits and classic albums like Up to Here, Road Apples, and Fully Completely, what started happening with the band members, Gord Downie, Gord Sinclair, Rob Baker, Johnny Fay, Paul Langlois, they quickly started to move from clubs and theaters to sold out arenas, slowly becoming one of the biggest bands in the country. And I don't know if this is exactly in the right timeline, but I read, Jake, that somewhere that you were working 18 hours a day in the basement of your home, sometimes just going upstairs for 6 hours a day to eat and to sleep. Like, you were married to this.
It was probably the demise of my first marriage because of that. but we're still friends, you know, but we had moved the office. We bought a house and we moved the office into the basement of the house. And again, you know, there was no email then. And this was 92. So this was just around the time Fully Completely was going to come out.
Wow.
And we were, you know, that within that year, they were recording Fully Completely that year. And they were touring all over the world. And so you had to be on the phone. I'd be at my desk at 6 a.m.
Absolutely.
Honestly, and to this day, I feel the same way. I don't really feel like I work.
You love it so much. You
know, well, it's not even about loving it, because that assumes you love work. It's not that. It's a part of me. It's a part of what I do. You know, you talk about finding your bliss. Like, this is my bliss. Does it potentially affect relationships? Yeah. But this is what I love. I love thinking of things and creating interesting ideas and then seeing them through and then watching them happen. And so, yeah, so I don't mind it. I mean, I definitely treat my office today. I have an office in my home, but I treat it like I go to work. I sit down at 9:30 and at 5:30, 6 o'clock, I get up and
punch it. Punch the clock. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on my phone. I'm answering emails and things like that prior to and after. But, you know, weekends, I generally shut down today. I do make time for other things or evening things. And I've also managed over the years to make sure my clients know that there are boundaries.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you message me on the weekend, unless someone's dying, don't expect an answer till Monday, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Smart.
But I love what I do, so I don't feel like I'm working. It doesn't feel like work. I don't dig ditches. I'm not unloading trucks. I'm not doing manual labor. I'm not going to an office. I don't have a boss.
Totally. But you're driven. And what I've noticed is you are driven relentlessly. And I don't know if it's to succeed or you're driven because you're so passionate about it. But you're a pretty driven guy. What drives you? Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break and we'll find out all about that when we come back.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And I'm here with the Tragically Hip's longtime manager, Jake Gold. And just before the break, Jake, I was asking you what drives you so relentlessly.
Well, interestingly enough, my therapist would say that in my early years, I was driven by fear. but now I think I'm just driven because I like to get things done.
Yeah.
Like I said, I like to think of things, think of a great idea, maybe not always great, but think of an idea and then figure out how to pull it off and then pull it off and watch it unfold.
Absolutely.
You know, even the documentary, when we were getting the episodes, I would play them for the record company and just to get them all excited about what they were about to be involved with.
Wow.
And so we have meetings every 2 weeks. And once we got out of COVID, we were meeting in person every 2 weeks. And then once the doc was finished, we submitted it in February, March. Then we started having meetings with the people that we have. Our book came out October 1st with the book. We had meetings with the PR teams from the book, the record company, and the Amazon Prime team every week. So it was always about making sure everyone was on the same page, that everyone was contributing to this rollout of everything we were doing.
Wow.
And then we watched it unfold as we did it.
And I want to get to all of that because it was, I've actually seen it three times because I saw it Thursday night. I saw it Friday night with that full audience when you were there with Mike Downey. And that was just unparalleled.
I didn't know you were there. You should have said hello.
I know. I should have come up and said hello. And I wanted to, but I'm glad I'm seeing you now. I was just, well, we're going to talk about that later on because that was just an evening I'll never forget. Like that was, I think that was a 10-minute standing ovation. I don't know. It was a long one.
Yeah.
And the feeling, the crying, the tears, the emotion, the laughter, the rocking it out. I said I'd talk about it later. It's like impossible not to talk about it. And you up there with Mike, and Mike was so emotional, he couldn't even speak at first. It was unbelievable. But I want to go back a little bit because I want to go to how you're taking them. You're climbing up this ladder with remarkable speed and alacrity with them. And then Saturday Night Live happens. And there's Dan Aykroyd introducing the hip. I mean, the fact that you got them to Saturday Night Live, like, that is freaking huge. That's big, big.
I can't take credit for that. And Dan says it in the documentary. Saturday Night Live at that point was having a lot of issues. People didn't know if people were going to watch it. Like, there was a lot of unrest. The media was all over them. And so Lorne Michaels was pulling out all the stops to try and reinvigorate it. And he approached Dan about coming on to host the show. Now, there's a really important distinction. Dan has a philosophy that former cast members should never host the show. That's his personal philosophy. So if you notice that night, Dan was on the show doing everything that a host would do.
Yeah.
Except John Goodman hosted the show. Right. Because when it cuts to the end, it's John Goodman saying goodbye to everybody and thank you all for being here and thanks to the Tragically Hip and all that other stuff.
Wow.
So Dan says it in the doc, you know, Lorne wanted him to come back and Dan said, okay, but you got to take my band. You got to take my friend's band. You know, they're worthy of it. And I remember we were with Atlantic Records in the U.S. at the time. And I got a call from the PR department. And now I already knew we were going to be on, but I didn't say anything. And they called me, the PR department, and said, you've just been asked to be on Saturday Night Live. And they were scratching their heads. And I was like, oh, yeah.
And poker face. So, good poker face.
Well, yeah, but we weren't doing Zoom, so nobody saw my face. So, yeah, so that ended up happening. But that was a crazy year for the band. We did our first ever arena tour in Canada. So we played Maple Leaf Gardens for the first time in February. Wow. We did 30 shows with Page Plant that year, Led Zeppelin. And then we did 4 shows with the Rolling Stones in Europe that year. We did the arena tour for Day for Night, and we did another roadside attraction in the summer, that summer. And then we did Saturday Night Live. And that was all in 1995. So, yeah. That was kind of a crazy year for a record that really didn't have, you know, what you would think of as, in today's terms, sort of big radio hits. The record's gone on to be a lot of hip fans' favorite albums.
Yes.
And there's certain songs on it that stick out, Grace 2 and Nautical Disaster. But they weren't like Courages or Head by a Century or Bob Cajun, which were big radio hits, you know?
Right. That Grace 2, though, that moment, and we actually have a very short clip from that moment on SNL. So they all got a little high backstage. They're all a little bit nervous. It was SNL, after all, biggest show ever, even if it was going through a difficult year. And all of a sudden, there's Gord Downie opening the song, and he changes the opening lyrics from, he said, I'm fabulously rich, to, he said, I'm tragically hip, which was so great. You couldn't buy this kind of PR because he's just telling all of North America, this band that you're seeing now is the Tragically Hip. Like, wow. So would you think that he knew what he was doing?
No. 2 things you need to know. And when you watch it back, it'll make sense. So yes, they smoked some weed, or hash or whatever, but that was a normal thing. That wasn't an abnormal thing.
Right.
But Gord's nephew was turning 11 that day. And the week before, his nephew had asked him if he could do a bit of a shout out to him from Saturday Night Live. So what Gord did is when he started the song, he was so concerned about doing the shout out, he held his fingers up like this as 11. Yeah. But all he heard in his head was Dan saying, the Tragically Hip, the Tragically Hip, the Tragically Hip.
Wow.
And so he was literally repeating what Dan said.
Oh my God. But I mean, call it whatever you want. Like, how great was that? How great was that moment? For the rest of their career, that lyric stayed, and it was unqualifiably a night of triumph.
Except that all of us at the time were like, what did he do? Interestingly enough, when we were touring with Page Plant, Robert Plant loved the band and he would hang out with us all the time in our dressing room and everything. And he came up to me one day and he goes, I just love how the band opens our show, because we would go on first. He goes, with the line, "You say I'm fabulously rich," because they would always open the set with Grace too. And he loved the fact that the show, meaning the whole show, opened with that lyric.
That line, that lyric.
Right? So even after Saturday Night Live, on the Paige Plant shows, Gord was singing the right lyrics. Over time, he would change them.
Yeah.
Right? But it would always have to be when it was an ironic moment, you know? But
cool.
he did sing that line a lot. But in the final show in Kingston, he did not sing that line. He sang Fabulously Rich.
He did.
Yeah.
Wow, that show. Oh, that's a whole other story. Grace 2, we got a little clip from that performance from SNL. I think we've set it up. Let's roll that clip. That was unbelievable. So 1995, you said this already. It wasn't just like an epiphany for you to know that they'd really made it beyond our borders. This was this fabulous year and capped by this Saturday Night Live thing. It was all going so well. And you really brought them to this place. I don't know if they would have gotten anywhere near there without you, because everybody needs a great manager. There's no question. So fast forward now to 8 years later, that fateful day, and it's in the film and it's kind of heartbreaking. You find out that the band wanted to part with management. That must have been brutal for you. How did you find out?
So remember, we had put out Day for Night, then Trouble at the Hen House, then Phantom Power, then Music at Work. Then we put out In Violet Light. And at that point, there was a lot of unrest with the guys and me and themselves and communicating with each other. Gord had moved to Toronto. There was a lot of unrest, and it's illustrated in the documentary.
Yes.
They called a meeting, and I thought we were going to discuss this new deal that was being put on the table by the record company that we had gone back and forth on. And we sat down. It was at the Soho Metropolitan Hotel in which was used to be on Chestnut Street. It's a different name now, in a room there. And Gord pulls out this letter and starts reading me the letter that he wrote.
Oh boy.
He read it to me. In the doc, Mike found the letter in Gord's archive and hands it to me. But that was the first time I actually held it or saw it, was in the doc. He didn't tell me he was going to give me the letter. That was all a surprise. So it was all... what you see in the documentary is completely spontaneous. But Gord read it to me. I never actually saw it, per se. He was sitting beside me. But I also continued to manage Gord's solo stuff after that another couple of albums. Yeah.
Wow.
Because I think he wanted me to stay, and I think there was so much unrest. We were neighbors. We lived, you know, 8 houses down the street from each other. I had lived in New York for some time because it was important to stay on top of the record company in that era. And his then mother-in-law was renting my house from me, which was down the street from his house. So
we
were very close. And I think there was some unrest about how maybe they felt I was too close to Gord, or, you know, whatever it was. But there was a lot of unrest amongst everybody. Nobody was communicating.
Right. They needed therapy. It said in the film they needed therapy, and they didn't go to therapy, but they probably could have benefited from it as a group even to go to therapy together, but they didn't do that. And instead, you sort of became the fall guy. I mean, you were still with Gord, but that must have hurt a lot. Like, I know you're a tough guy, and I know that you ended up with them again and bigger and better than ever, and you've been with them. You are their manager. You're the longtime manager forever and always. But those couple of years must have been really brutal.
Well, it was 17 years. It was 17 years between then and when I came back.
Yeah.
You know, at first, it was a bit of a gut punch, but at the same time, there was so much stress happening for all of us, that it was almost a relief, because all of a sudden I realized I don't have this stress anymore.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, I got a call to be on this television show. So, and people were like, wow, like, look at you. One door closes, another one opens. And I'm like,
pretty lucky.
And
lucky.
If I was if I was still managing the act, they wouldn't have called me.
Of course not. Because they would have known there was no time, no space. Because this Canadian Idol was a full-time thing. You were one of the top judges.
It wasn't full-time though, Judy. But I will say, because I could still run my business and everything, but it's not something the guys would have appreciated. Let's just say that. Right. They were, in fact, when I first got approached, I turned them down because I didn't think it was my world.
Right.
You know, I thought it was kind of pop and not really the kind of singers that I work with, because I work with creators and people that do their own music. And here was basically what I thought was a glorified karaoke show.
Right.
Which wasn't really my world. And then I remember coming home to my then now ex-wife, second time, saying to her that, hey, I got a call to do this, but I don't think I'm going to do it. And she said, oh, you should think about it. I think you'll be good. And I went, I'll take a meeting with them. And I took a meeting, and you know, the rest is history. So that lasted a good 6 years. But what it did was it kept me busy, but it also introduced me to the television business.
Yes.
It introduced me to a whole new set of contacts. And all of a sudden I'm in a band, because me and the other judges, we were the talent, and we're on the road and we're going to different cities together. And, you know,
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. Right? It's true.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So for our audience, what Jake is talking about is he became one of the top judges on Canadian Idol for 6 seasons. It was hosted by Ben Mulrooney, and the judges were always Jake Gold at the helm and Farley Flex, Sass Jordan, and Zach Werner. So was it a fun gig? At the end of the day, like, was it a trip?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, the audition days were very difficult. They were long days. So we would be on set from 7 a.m., 7:30 a.m. till sometimes 9, 10 o'clock at night. Because we were seeing a lot of people in every one of these cities. The live shows, we'd show up at 5:30, we'd go live at 7, done by 8. I'm home by 8:30. That was easy.
Sweet.
But the audition days, you know, we'd fly out the day before, we'd do 1 or 2 days in every city and then fly back. But, you know, I was one of the first ones to have a BlackBerry. And so I was dealing with emails and everything in between takes or when we'd have breaks all the time. And everybody was like, what do you work? What do you have? And because they would all have to go back to their rooms to go on their computers and everything else. And then eventually everybody got a BlackBerry and then, you know, we moved on and everything. But
that's hilarious. So
I was able to do my job, and I had great people working with me at the time at the office. And so I was able to do my job at the same time and do everything. And the travel wasn't
onerous.
We were flying first class all the time. It was suites and hotels.
Nice.
You know, we got significant amounts of money for clothes for the show. And so we were being treated really, really well, and we got paid really well. So it was definitely the easiest money I ever made. And it was fun, and I learned a lot from it. And still to this day, in fact, one of the main executives at Amazon Prime in Canada is a guy that worked at CTV then, that worked with the Canadian Idol. And so we laugh about it, about how we met 20 years ago, you know, or more. So
fun. Did you ever meet Simon Cowell and compare notes?
No, I never did. A guy named Simon Fuller created the show. He was the guy. He was the guy that was the Spice Girls manager. He created the show. Interesting thing about him is that when Sass Jordan was living in Montreal, when she was first starting her career, he had come to Montreal to try and get something going in the music industry. And through a friend of a friend, was sleeping on her couch, right? So she had known Simon since like back then. And so he came to a couple of days of a shooting, a live show day, and then a results day. So we spent some time hanging out with Simon Fuller, who I had way more in common with because he was a manager. And and remember, Harley was a manager, Zach was a manager, I was a manager.
Right.
Sass was the performer, was the artist.
You managed Sass. Didn't you also manage Sass?
Yeah, well, we met on the show, and I managed her for about 9 years. Yeah. But so Simon, I had more interest in meeting Simon Fuller than meeting Simon Cowell. Like to me, right. Simon Fuller was the guy who created the show and he was a manager. Sure. And he had an affinity to Canada and obviously he knew SAS. So we spent some time with him. In season two, we were the first to have any of the contestants play instruments because we had this group of top 10 that were all could play instruments. Awesome. And we had to get permission to do that. And then the next year, the American show launches and they do a show and they say, for the first time ever on Idol, we're going to play instruments. It's like, no, we did that last year.
We were the first.
Yeah, so there was a lot of those kinds of things where we were kind of breaking the rules and setting the new way of doing things. And then they would take credit for it because in their mind, the Americans in their mind was, there was only one Idol and that was American Idol. So.
Right. So just to get straight the timeline. So you were with the Tragically Hip as their longtime manager for 17 years. And now you are again, but 17 years. Then you took off 17 years and you did Canadian Idol and managed other bands and did other things. And now you hear that Gord Downie is sick. And when you first heard his diagnosis, how did you find out? And what was your reaction?
I found out the way everybody else found out via the news that day.
Yeah.
And they were keeping it pretty quiet. One of the two guys that, there was another management firm for about a year and a half. And then these two guys that took over after, one used to work for me and one was my roommate for 4 years. So,
Is this Bernie?
Bernie and Patrick. So Bernie worked out of my office for 5 years.
Oh my God.
And Patrick was my roommate for 4 years. And so they took over. And I guess there was a familiarity with sort of my style because of they had learned a lot from me over the years.
Of course.
But Patrick and I were still friends and we'd play tennis together. And I would run into him when this was all, when Gord was sick, but I didn't know Gord was sick. And he would say things to me like, yeah, things aren't good, but I can't really talk about it. So he wouldn't tell me. He wouldn't tell me what was going on. And so when I found out, I remember calling him. I said, why didn't you tell me? Like, why did I have to find out from the rest of the world? Because I was always, Gord and I would communicate, but it wasn't like a daily thing.
Brutal.
And yeah, so I found out the same way he did, the way everybody else did, the way you did and everybody else.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was definitely hard to hear. But again, not being inside, had no idea the extent or how long or what he was capable of. And so over time, I would get information, at least I was now getting in some more inside information. And then when they announced the tour, I remember writing to Patrick. I said, well, I want to come to the shows. So, so I went to six of the shows. I went to two in Vancouver. I went to two in Toronto. I went to Hamilton and I went to Kingston.
And Kingston was the last night. And I want people to see the four-part docuseries, The Tragically Hip, No Dress Rehearsal, because it's freaking unbelievable. I just encourage everyone to go to Amazon Prime and go watch this four-part docuseries, because there's things that you're going to see and hear that you've never seen and heard before. But what shocked me was the fact that this tour even happened. He couldn't remember lyrics. He needed a teleprompter. There was four color coding, like the pen, his favorite pen that had the four different colors.
Right.
No one thought it was possible. The band member said, I don't think this is going to happen, but it somehow gave him strength and he built it up every night. He got better and better and better and better. And they did that last night in Kingston. And it was like, it was heartbreaking. And you were there and you've even talked in the film and you're in the film a lot. And I love that. You were bawling your eyes out. Can you tell us what
it was the next day, just so everyone knows. Yes, Gord was using teleprompters for lyrics, but when we toured with Paige Plant in 95, Robert Plant had a teleprompter, so it's not unusual when you have that amount of material. And I think also what was important to know is that, because when I was at the shows, I would hang out with Paul afterwards. And Paul was building the sets for the show, the set lists. And Gord insisted that they play music from all the albums they ever recorded on the tour at some point, which meant that they had to learn all these songs and even ones that they hadn't played forever. So one of the, it was one thing to remember lyrics, but it's another thing to remember all the songs you've ever written lyrics. So that was a big reason for, there were certain songs they may have only played two or three times on the whole tour, but they had to have those lyrics in the teleprompter. So Paul would build the sets, hand it in to everybody, and then Billy Ray, the tech guy, would load them up into the teleprompter. So there was a lot of that going on. But again, I didn't know any of that was going on. I knew he had a teleprompter. I knew he had to use all that. But I didn't know the extent of everything that was going on until after. But in terms of the final show, it was a beautiful, beautiful sunny day in August. And it was all these people on the street and went to the show and then went out after. And the next day I was staying in a really nice bed and breakfast in Kingston. I woke up in the morning and it was pouring rain and gray and dark. And it just was a reminder of kind of what we had the night before and now what we have. And that's when I sort of broke down because I went, you know, it's over. Like, this is it. And it was almost like someone was saying, yeah, well, you know, the sun shone yesterday, but not today.
Wow.
And that's exactly what happened. And there was a friend of mine. She's a writer. She drove up with me and then we drove back together. And she said the same thing. She goes, isn't it crazy that today's like the worst possible day? And we're having to drive in this rain. And yesterday was this beautiful sunny day. So. Wow.
Well, that night, I mean, I don't know, just seeing that part of the film, you guys have to see this part of the film. And when they do Ahead by a Century and everyone's melding the words, I mean, everyone's melding the words, the audience, it's just packed, packed, packed. And everybody's crying. And it's like our national anthem, this song. It's no longer, and somewhere in the film, they say, you know, there's no religious leader or political leader or corporate leader that could create this kind of emotion and vibe. There was something about him and the band that was able to achieve all of this. And so we have an excerpt from the song Ahead by a Century that I'd love to share with our audience. And I think this song is considered to be sort of a second national anthem. So let's have a little excerpt of Ahead by a Century. Due to international copyright law, podcasts are unable to include music. Music can only be played on the live radio broadcast. Finding Your Bliss airs every Saturday at 1 p.m. If you'd like to hear this artist's music, you can find the link to our Finding Your Bliss SoundCloud in the episode description. Oh my God. That song, I don't know what it is. It gets into my bones. It gets into everyone's bones. That lyric, that's when the hornet stung me. It's like we were all stung by this terrible diagnosis that Gord Downie had received. And I don't know, I just felt that the whole audience, when they sang that line, they were feeling it so intensely. And I can't even, that night. What was that moment like for you?
Honestly, I remember it was the final song, but I was in it. So I think looking back on it now, I have a different memory of it than when I was actually in the room.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think being in the room, you were a part of it, so you weren't thinking about what it was at the time. I think it's a reflective thing now. Like, I think for those people that watched it on TV, they probably saw it differently because they were also cutting away to other cities on TV and everything else. When you're in the room, you didn't see any of that. You didn't see that there were people in Cape Breton and people in Vancouver and people in Edmonton and Calgary and places like that singing it, which when you watched it on TV, you did. But that's not how we saw it. Right.
Yes,
so I was at a show. I was just happy that they came out. They did 9 encore songs. I was just happy that they came out for the first one and played Locked in the Trunk of a Car. You know,
I know that farewell performance was really something and it was so heartbreaking and yet so hopeful at the same time. We're going to find out more about the film and the filmmaker Mike Downie when we come back.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back. This is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And I'm here with Jake Gold. And we're talking about the film, The Tragically Hip, No Dress Rehearsal. And I just wanted to say, the film that just premiered at TIFF that's now on Amazon Prime, The Tragically Hip, No Dress Rehearsal, was directed and produced by Gord Downie's brother, of course, Mike Downie, with you as the executive producer, Jake Gold. It really clarified something, which was that Ireland had U2. They say this at the beginning of the film. The UK had the Beatles and Canada had The Tragically Hip. And they were more than a rock and roll band. They were so authentically Canadian. We were so cleaved to them in every way. And I wonder if that was just the great storytelling, the great lyrics, the magic and the credibleness of Gord Downie and of the band members, or also the fact that they were all mensches. They were just nice guys. And there was something about the film, as sad as it was at the ending, that it gives you hope. But if I ask you about Gord Downie, the lead singer, the front man, the magic, that soul, that goodness in him, I don't know, there's something, as you know, as everyone knows. What are some words that would just come to mind about the late beloved Gord?
Authentic. Authentic.
Yeah. Pretty incredible. And you were asked to come back. You were kind of begged to come back in 2020. And when the other guys left, you said, listen, it's pretty obvious for me. It's part of my legacy. So when I heard that the former managers resigned, I was like, there's only one guy that should be taking over and it should be me. And they all agreed. And in fact, Downey's brother, Patrick, issued a statement. The Downey family is very happy to be reuniting with Jake. We see no better person to serve the legacy and future works of Gord Downie and of The Tragically Hip. We are truly excited for everyone, especially the fans. Or Peaches and Herb said, we're reunited and it feels so good working with our original dance partner and architect. And you became almost not only their manager again and the executive producer of the film, but you've even said that you were like the archaeologist helping to dig for stuff to put this film together. What was that like, just very briefly?
Well, the doc team had a great research team, so there was that. But one of the first things I did, I have a very close friend who does what I do, except he does it for the Beatles. And he was our marketing guy for our first couple of albums in the U.S. And I called him up and I said, any advice? And he said, first figure out what you got, then you'll know what to do.
Right.
So I hired this archival team that does a lot of big bands around the world. And they came in and they literally emptied out storage lockers and basements of all the guys. And they brought everything to this warehouse in Guelph. And they started to build the archive. And they built it digitally. So they scanned every item that we had. And it was all barcoded and labeled. And so it was searchable. And then they built the physical archive. We rent two rooms from Iron Mountain. And the physical archive stays there. So we did that. At the same time, Johnny, the drummer, worked with Universal, the record company, on digitizing all the tapes and everything that hadn't been digitized, because a lot of it was tape. So you had to transfer it. And the older stuff, you have to bake it first. There's a whole technical side to how you restore everything. And then all the video had to be digitized, and all the outtakes from all the videos that were made. So when Mike started to make the doc, he had this treasure trove of stuff, but everything was also organized and cataloged and researched so his team could go in and pick and choose the stuff they needed. And so if they needed a particular photo or a magazine article or a headline or something from one of the ephemera archives, they could go to the room, pull the original document, and then shoot it for the doc and then put it back. So all that is still exists. We had a book just came out October 1st called This Is Our Life, No Dress Rehearsal, This Is Our Life, which is written by the guys. It won't be on the radio, but I can show it to you. There it is.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
We actually have a big event on November 1st in Toronto at Massey Hall. If you buy a ticket, you'll get a copy of the book with your ticket. And Tara Sloan, is going to interview the four guys on stage to talk about the book and talk about their 40-year career. And we may have some special guests show up, and there'll be screens so people will be able to see images from the book and close-ups of the guys. So we're producing it like a real show. There won't be performance, but there'll be a chance for fans to ask questions and everything else. And that's happening on Friday, November 1st at Massey Hall in Toronto.
I'm coming to that. Well, this is also, I literally have another 38 questions. I know I can't ask them, but I have so much to say. What are some of the next things that you're doing?
Well, we have this event coming up. And we have a box set coming out November 8th. And then we're going to take a little bit of a break. But it's interesting, the doc is getting so much great word of mouth around the world.
Yes.
Where we thought most of our media was done, now all of a sudden media from around the world wants to talk to everybody. So now we have another 2 weeks of interviews and things going on. And I think it's just going to keep going because everybody who sees it seems to love it. And, you know, we made it from a very authentic place. So I think that's what's resonating with people, is how honest and open and how it's not just a puff piece to promote some tour or something that we're doing. Yes. It represents who the guys are, which is they were all authentic, and that we made a film that's authentic. So
much so. It's unbelievable. I feel like this film is Mike Downey's love letter to his brother, but the film is also a love letter to everyone, hip fans all over the world. And just as you said, it's kind of taken on a life of its own.
I think it's also a love letter to Canada.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I think it's a love letter to Canada. You know, Mike made a really interesting comment that when the hip came around, where they said, you know, we're going to be authentic to who we are. We're going to write songs about Canada because that's what we know. And that the fans were ready, Canadians at the time were now ready to say, yeah, we got something to be proud of. Because up until that point, Canada was not a very nationalistic country, and still to this day isn't really a nationalistic country. We're not flag wavers like Americans are, mm-hmm. right? It's never been our thing. But I think there was a certain, you know, Trudeau says it, that there was a quiet pride yes. in it. And I think that there was a point there where a lot of Canadian bands starting to come out that Canadians could stand behind and saying, these are ours.
Yes.
And we just, George says in the doc, he said, you know, Canada was ready for this band because this band came along to say, hey, we're Canadian. We're proud of it. We're not trying to be something we're not. And I think at that point, Canada went, yeah, you're right. We can stand behind these guys.
Absolutely.
And so that's why I think it's a love letter to Canada as well.
Absolutely true. Also, those scenes you're talking about, George Strombopoulos, Strombo, there's these scenes with that chandelier and they're pretty incredible.
That's in his house. Yeah. That's where he shoots all his stuff on Richmond Street. So,
yeah. So fabulous. There's a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show. And of course, we're going to ask it to you. I think you might've already answered it, but I'm going to ask it to you. What is bliss for Jake Gold?
My true, true, real bliss is hitting a forehand winner off a big serve.
That's so cool. I'd love to see that sometime in action. I want to see the video.
I play at the Boulevard Club in Toronto, so tennis is my thing. That and listening to Peter Gabriel. So those are my two big blisses. Yeah.
It's been a real honor to have you on the show, Jake. Really, it's been absolutely delightful. I could have talked for another 2 hours. Maybe you'll come back.
We'll have to do part 2, 3, and 4, Judy.
Let's do it.
You'll do your own version.
Sounds great. I want to thank you so much. What's the best way, Jake, for people to stay connected to the Tragically Hip and stay connected to everything?
Yeah, I mean, thehip.com is the best way for the band. We were way ahead on the digital world. We registered thehip.com in 1994, long before anybody was doing things like that. Go to my website if you're a young band and want to submit stuff. You know, we're always looking, and that's at mgmtrust.ca.
Nice. Thank you. Each week we spotlight a fabulous person like Jake Gold, who is really living their bliss. So if you're one of those people, reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. Also, we love to feature singers and musicians on this show. So if you're a singer, reach out to us. You can do that at fyb@findyourbliss.com. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. I would love to thank our wonderful guest, Jake Gold, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to our wonderful team at Finding Your Bliss. Thank you to everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Lee Brack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.